Cheers, being sponsored, Leilui Nishmas, Maris Mala Bas Rav Yehuda Leiv, Zichrona Livracha, and Maris Malcha Bas Rav Mordechai Ziskin, Zichrona Livracha. I'd like to speak about one pasuk in Mirtz Hashem today, one Rashi on this pasuk, and really try to build a world view based on this pasuk, looking at it from two really diametrically, I don't know if diametrically opposite, from different perspectives to understand this Rashi. And we are going to elicit a tremendous amount of food for thought in Mirtz Hashem today. In this week's Parsha Vayishlach, we have the following story. Source 1. Now Dina, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Yaakov, went out to look over the daughters of the land. And Shechem, son of Hamor, the Chivite, the prince of the region, saw her, he took her, he lay with her, and violated her. He became a deeply attached to Dina, daughter of Yaakov. He loved the maiden and appealed to the maiden's emotion. So Shechem spoke to Hamor's father, saying, take me the girl for a wife. And then it talks about how the brothers come up with this plan where they say, we'll only give our sister to you if you have a bris milah, circumcision. The whole town has a circumcision. And Shimon and Levi, the brothers of Dina, come and destroy the whole town and ultimately take all the women, children, and the possession as spoils. There is a tremendous amount to say and to learn and to delve into what the Torah is teaching us about this section. And obviously we don't have the time or the wherewithal to even begin to raise all these issues today. I'd like to focus in on the first verse of this very unfortunate incident. Now Dina, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Yaakov. So the Ner Uziel in source number 2 points out, Rashi's curiosity is aroused by the fact that the verse traces Dina's lineage to her mother, which does not conform to Torah's standard pattern of focusing exclusively on patrilineal descent. We would have expected the verse to say, Dina, the daughter of Yaakov, went out. And therefore Rashi explains that Dina is associated with Leah, her mother, because she inherited her mother's extroverted personality. Like her, Leah was an outgoing person. Where do we see that Leah was an outgoing person? The Torah says when Yaakov came home from the field that evening, Leah went out to meet him. This is the story in last week's parsha of the Dudayim, the mandrakes that her son Reuven acquired, and she gave them to Rachel in exchange for Yaakov that night, and she goes out and greets Yaakov and says, I've acquired you tonight. And that night indeed she is able to become pregnant and bears a son Yisachar, who we know was a tremendous Talmid Chacham and one of the leaders in learning of the Jewish people. And Rashi adds that this verse is the source of the popular adage, like mother, like daughter. According to this, and this will be our first of the two approaches today, what Dina did was there's something inherently wrong. Vateitse Dina is a critique. And not only is she critiqued, but it's Vateitse Dina bas Leah. Leah is also critiqued for going out as well. And here the Shirei Das, Rav Bloch, tells the Rosh Yeshiva, notes in source 4, that even though the Gemara tells us that there was a tremendous shevach, there was a tremendous praise for Leah Menu, that she wanted to have as many shvatim as possible, as many tribes as possible. And she went out in order to do this, l'shem shemayim, for the purpose of heaven. That her going out was in order to really, a desire to have as many tribes as possible, and that's why she came out to greet her husband. Nevertheless, says the Shirei Das, in the middle of 4, V'afal pikein, yardu chachameinu zal, l'toch emek nefesh adam. And we see that in the inner depths that this good act had within it a tchuna, a character trait, which went against the mita of snius, of modesty, of kok vuda b'melech panima, that the glory of a bas melech, of a king's daughter, of a Jewish woman is inward. And we learn from here is that Dina on some level inherited, and obviously adding to her own personality, but inherited this character trait of going out, which was above and beyond, which is appropriate for a Jewish woman, And therefore, Dina got into the trouble that she got into. Umizriak tanazu shebanefesh. Even though this was a tiny seed, it was so small, it was perhaps imperceptible. Nevertheless, yatsa davanara, something terrible ensued as a result. And we see here on this level that a Jewish woman has to be very careful how she goes out, because a woman's place is an inner place. Leah going out, Dina going out, is critiqued by the Torah. Now, having said this, I'd like to try to speak about today, really unusual that we'll spend most of the time developing one halach, one mindset. I'd like to speak about a topic which Rabbi Frand, in a sefer Rabbi Frand in print, in source number 5, says that he begin speaking about this topic with trepidation. And unlike shalom bayis, marital harmony, and educating one's children, this is a subject that elicits very strong feelings. And what I'd like to speak about today, and really raise quite a number of issues, and try to look at it from many different vantage points, is women going out specifically into the working environment. Vateitze Dina, what does it mean for women to go out into an alien environment like Dina did? Now, I'll say at the outset, I do work. I Baruch Hashem, work within a religious environment. So a lot of what I'm speaking about, I can, and I will, Mirtz Hashem, speak about from a personal perspective of the struggles, but some of them I do face, and some of them I like to speak about, which people who work in the secular workplace definitely many times confront. The first point Rabbi Frand notes is that if you're entering in six an environment that doesn't even begin to understand what you're all about, in fact, you really should carry a passport with you every single morning when you go to work. And he's talking about men as well as women, because you're going from your strong Jewish enclaves, whatever they may be, into a foreign country, a country that doesn't understand necessarily about kashrus, about Shabbos, doesn't understand about Pesach, and they have an entirely different value system. Now, obviously, as he notes here, it's an undeniable fact that a large percentage of Orthodox women today work outside the home, and generally that is a necessity because of the financial constraints that we are under, tuition being a major one, medical care, etc. Having said this, and I understand that this is the reality, let's speak about the specific challenges of the woman in the workplace. We'll touch maybe at the end about a man as well. What is the nature of a woman? What are the challenges of Vateitze Dina Batzlea, of a woman going out? There's a wonderful essay on the next page in Nefesh Chaya by Rav Pinchas Satzel, where he speaks about that very enigmatic medrash, where when God created the Me'orot HaGdolim, the two great luminaries in heaven, the sun and the moon. So the Medrash tells us that the moon complained, and the moon said, it's not fair, it's not correct to have two, you know, people ruling in the sky in the same size. So God says, okay, you make yourself smaller, and the moon complains, this isn't fair, and in the end, God gives the moon Rosh Chodesh. It's a very, very fascinating Medrash, which Rav Pinchas discusses in its entirety. It's not my focus today, so I'm just going to mention the bottom line. Rafikas explains that originally, this is source number 8, that when God created these two great luminaries, the sun and the moon reflected the sun entirely. It wasn't like there were two bodies, the sun and the moon, and they each generated their own light. There were two great forces, but from the beginning, the moon reflected the light of the sun. And the moon's contention was in source number 9. Why should I just be a reflection of the sun? I want to have a relationship directly with you, God. The sun is getting its energy from you. I don't want to reflect the sun. I want to reflect you. And that's why the moon is ultimately given Rosh Chodesh. And Rosh Chodesh is the time when the Beis Din, the Sanhedrin, the court of Jewish law, decides when the new month will be and the holidays will be. And that is the moon's way of, or God's way of saying to the moon, you are going to be directly connected to me, to my Beis Din, to my court of Jewish law. Having said this, He then uses the model of the sun and the moon to be a model of the man and the woman. When we look at the blessings that are said, the Birkos HaShachar in the morning, so many people are very upset, many women, by the blessing that men say, Shelo Asani Isha, thank God you didn't make me a woman. And it seems from this blessing that men are much better than women. Yet, if we read the next line, what do women say? Thank God, Shasani Kirtzano, you have made me according to your will. What is the difference between thank God you didn't make me a woman and creating me according to your will? And in fact, the Gemara says, Gedola haftacha shivtichana kadosh baruch hu l'nashim yoter min hanashim. Greater is the reward that women get than men get. What is the intrinsic difference? Now obviously, again, this is a major shear that we're just going to distill down in a number of minutes for our purposes. A man, to a large extent, in 19, is the shemesh, is the generator, is the ore, is the light. He is the one who creates a tremendous amount of powerful light. And that's why a man is obligated in mitzvot, obligated in Talmud Torah, he's obligated in everything that's going to bring him to Kedusha, and that to holiness. And that is the job of every Jew, to bring the person closer to God. And Torah and mitzvot are the way that he generates that light, that energy, to be able to create that relationship. If the man is compared to the sun, woman is compared to the moon. The moon, Lumato 14, Haisha hi kemo hayareach. Woman is like the yareach. Ein la or atzmi. She does not have her own light. It's not that she generates her own light, but rather she is like a mar'ah. She is a mirror image. She reflects. And perhaps maybe better than a mirror or different than a mirror, it's like a filter. While a man has his own energy and is able to generate this energy and is involved in Torah and mitzvot, a woman per se is a reflection of her environment, and she is able to filter from that which she reflects to those who are around her. And that is why a woman does not need to have the Torah and mitzvot per se, because a woman who turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a woman who spends her day in a relationship with God, is focused toward that reality. And when she's focused toward that reality, she is reflecting Kedusha. She is reflecting holiness. She is bringing down, she is filtering down into her home, into her environment, a feeling, a level of closeness to God. And that's why the model that Rav Pinkus gives in 18 is, let's say you take a picture of the Chafetz Chaim, and then you take a mirror image of an animal, let's say. So which is greater, a picture of the Chafetz Chaim or the mirror image of an animal? Obviously the picture of the Chafetz Chaim. But let's say you take a picture of the Chafetz Chaim and a mirror image of Yoshua ben Nun. Who's greater? Obviously, even though it's a mirror image, the mirror image of Yoshua ben Nun is greater than the picture. The man has the ability to generate light. He's the picture. But he's limited in that which he creates. That which he creates is that is who he is. That's where it begins and that's where it ends. A woman, on the other hand, and that's why Nashim Daisan Kalos we could add, she has a different flexibility and a different level of energy that extends really beyond herself. She is not limited to the picture. She is a mirror. And when you are a mirror, you are encompassing a lot more than just the picture. The mirror entails her to grow to levels beyond where she is at, to bring in a tremendous amount of energy. And this is why Rav Pinkus says that a woman is called Eshet Chayil Ateret Baila. She is the crown of her husband. The crown is the keter on top of his head. She is the source of greatness for the family because she has the ability to directly bring down that influence of Kedusha to the family. And here Rav Pinkus says something very, very powerful. And I think it's very well worth for us to think about this. He tells a story, and I want us to work this through, of a man who sends a letter to El Al complaining about the pictures, the movies on El Al, they're just inappropriate. And the man ends this letter by saying, now obviously I wasn't looking at these movies because, you know, it's inappropriate, my wife was looking at them. Says Rav Finkus, and this is a very challenging statement. You know what he says? It's far, I won't say far worse, but it's worse for a woman to see this than a man. Why? Because you're right, for a man to see this is wrong, it's a begam in his neshama, there's a stain in his soul, these are inappropriate things for him to be looking at, granted. But for a woman, it's not only, and oftentimes it's for a woman perhaps it's not inappropriate, depending on what it is, but for a woman, that what she looks at is what she is right now. She is that mirror image. When she is looking at things that are inappropriate, that is the reflection that she becomes. And at that moment, that is what she is resonating out. And the woman, therefore, has a far greater challenge in this world to be able to give over the feelings of Kedusha, of holiness, than just being the here and now of the picture. And with this in mind, we understand why in 22, the Tisha Kabim, Asara Kabim Shalsicha Yardu La'olam, 10 aspects of speech came down to this world. Women took 9. It's not that they chatter a lot. Sicha, Vayetze Yitzchak Lasuch Basadeh is tefillah. A woman who is in prayer all day, a woman who is in communication with God all day, is a woman who is turned upward and is able to filter that experience of holiness to all those that surround her. The challenge of a woman is really far greater than a man. A woman's responsibility is to recognize that she reflects her environment and gives it off. And she has to be on a certain level even more careful, being this moon, being this reflector, than a man has to be. Having said this, we can now understand what is the role of the Jewish woman. So Rav Matisyahu Solomon, in his Sefer with Hearts Full of Faith, he notes, he says, when we describe Shifra and Pua in Egypt, the two midwives, these were women who were prophetess. They were an extraordinary high intellectual and spiritual level. And yet, they're described as midwives, as those who comfort infants. And he quotes in 25 the Panovich Rosh Yeshiva, who says, the primary role of the woman is to take care of the young, to care for them, nurture them, and mold them into people God meant them to be. It is a calling of the highest order, a calling that brings distinction and honor even to women who have attained the gift of prophecy. And that explains in the 5th chapter of Shoftim of Judges, when Devorah, the prophetess, who's both a prophetess, she's a warrior, she's a poetess, she has all these tremendous qualities. How does she describe herself? Ad shekamti Devorah, until I, Devorah, arose. Shekamti, that I arose, ein b'Yisrael, a mother in Israel. The highest accolade for a woman is to be a mother. Now, obviously, my friends, there are many people, and the single scenes today is a tragedy and a challenge. I have many students who are in this scene, so I'm very intimately aware of it. Many women who are chalishing to be in this situation. And what we're going to speak about, until Amir Tzashem, they do build houses, will be pertinent to them. But having said this, the major goal of a Jewish woman is ultimately, and it has not changed, to be the mainstay of the home, to raise children, to be this mirror image reflecting the Kedusha, the holiness, Ad Shekamti Ein B'Yisrael. And Rabbi Tinheller notes in her book, Bodies and Souls, she says, the crisis of American Judaism is the failure to transmit that 20th century oxymoron, Judaism without the home, a hopeless creature that has little chance of survival and virtually no chance to reproduce. Paralleling the devaluation of the home in secular society, certain strains of Judaism have endeavored to replace the home with a synagogue as a central locale for the observance of Judaism. Naturally, therefore, women who want to fully partake of Jewish observance have set their sights on practices that take place in the public setting of the synagogue. But, she notes in 27, the majority of the Jewish feminist movement's demands for equality thus have as their source the mistaken premise that the synagogue is the most significant place in Judaism, and therefore its roles and function are of primary importance in Jewish life. The truth is, that since the destruction of the temple 2,000 years ago, the home has been and continues to be the holiest and most important place for the practice of Judaism. Zachu, their worthy, Shechina Beinehem, the divine presence rests in a home. As Rav Pinkus speaks about, you should imagine there's an Aron Kodesh, a Sefer Torah in your home, and anything you feel would be appropriate to say or to read in the shul is what you should feel is appropriate to say or to read in your own home. And the home, she continues, is the domain of the woman. This is not only a Jewish concept, but a deep psychological axiom. Among the most basic symbols recognized in psychoanalysis are the enclosed structures symbolizing woman and the soaring, towering symbolizing man. These symbols are representative of basic psychological constructs that appear in dreams, drawings, etc. And she notes in 28, only in a society that does not recognize internal power and devalues the home could the notion of woman as powerless arise. The solution is not empowerment, but empowerment, the recognition of the inner power that has always been available to Jewish women. And that has to be understood before we can even speak about Vatetzei Dina, about Dina going out into the marketplace. Before we can even speak about what is it like for a Jewish woman to go out into the working world, we need to establish first and foremost that a Jewish woman is somebody who is a mirror, a reflection of the society of that which she focuses in on in her life. And we need to understand that ultimately a Jewish woman's focus should be that of Kedusha, that of holiness. She has this tremendous gift to be able to bring then that Shefa, that repository of holiness to all those around her. And to be able to build, and it's a schus, it's a merit to be able to build a Jewish home, to build small worlds into great people. And that's why Rabbi Sisyahu continues in 29, that people are born as babies because their characters have to be developed in stages before they can become adults. We are not like animals that are finished products as soon as they learn to walk and eat. An adult human being is full of complex emotion and personality traits that need to be molded very carefully. The process starts in the cradle and continues for the rest of his life. As he notes here, allowing a baby to cry, we're not talking about a peep, but to cry through the night because you want a good night's sleep, is setting up feelings perhaps of rejection that he says is cruel and insensitive. A mother's job is to be with her children. A mother's job is to be able to recognize that she needs to soothe the child. She needs to give the child that confidence that indeed she is here, that the child can cry and somebody is there to listen. And Rav Sisyahu continues and says it's not just the crying, it's not just the molding of characters. The Medrash tells us Rabbeinu Yonah brings down the idea in Igeres HaTshuva that why did Kadosh Baruch Hu speak to the women first in giving over the Torah before the men? Rabbeinu Yonah explains because they are the ones that send off their children to school and see to it that they study the Torah, and they are merciful when the children come home from school. So says the Masisyahu, listen to this Rabbeinu Yonah, it gives us a directive. The mother has to be merciful when the child comes home from school. He's had a hard day. He needs his mother to receive him, welcome him, and make him feel good. 32, next page. Imagine a mother greeting her child at the door in a stern teacher's voice. So what did you learn today in school? Do you know what your homework is? Did you behave yourself today? I want a full report. This is not what the child needs, an extension of the school he just left. He needs his home to be a place of refuge. He needs his mother to greet him with warmth and kindness, with a reassuring word, a cup of milk and a cookie. He needs his mother to put her arm around his shoulder and ask him how he's feeling. He needs a bit of mercy. Otherwise, he lives in school and at home with that same drill routine, and he has no outlet for most of his school years, but just one long sentence of hard labor. Now, what happens? It's not only with the children coming back from school that they need this warmth, and 33, they need to be sent to school this way, not criticizing, why did you drop the milk, and one sleeve out of his, you know, coat, and he's dragging his book bag, and he forgot his lunch. No, not with havoc, but with calmness, the child needs to leave his house. Unfortunately, 34, and I think many of us can relate to this, one of the most debilitating aspects of the dark, gullus exile in which we presently find ourselves is the ideal situations are hard to come by. Almost no one can live a natural, normal life any longer. Almost no one enjoys a life that is whole and tranquil, with the father and mother fulfilling their specific roles in building the family, establishing the home, and raising the children. Everything is artificial and contrived. What happens instead? When a woman goes out to work, one of the things that we need to realize that is a challenge and to be well aware of is that when a mother comes home from work, she is usually not a calm, relaxed type of person. She's often frustrated, exhausted by the strength and stresses of her work, of commuting, and the pressures that she is under, not to mention the preparation she may have when she brings home. Such a mother, 36, cannot really go out to the workplace because by the time she returns, she's the abused one, the one that's had it, the one that's desperately in need of mercy and comforting. When she returns home exhausted from the workplace, her child is already waiting for her at the babysitter and everything's turned on its head. He is the one who has to welcome and comfort her rather than the other way around. But which child is clever enough to welcome his overworked mother properly? Instead of soothing her, he's more likely to whine and complain and add to her stress and strain. And this is how their day comes to an end. Not exactly an ideal situation. And that's why he notes in 37, before a mother is able to walk into the door, she needs to be able to compose herself, to calm herself down, and recognize that the mood that she's in, that aspect of reflection, is going to set the stage for the rest of the family. So the first aspect that I want to focus in on, that a woman going out to work, is that a woman has to understand that she is given this incredible gift called raising children. And yes, that is her major focus. And yes, there is an economic necessity that a woman needs to go out to work. But let us be aware of the price that we are paying and how exhausted we are and how tired we are dealing with our children because of these challenges that we have working outside the home, and it's not the ideal situation. What brings to mind, which is a story I don't think I'll ever forget, is when Rachel was in first grade, starting first grade. So she was very anxious, as many children are, about starting a new environment in Hebrew. She was only in the country a year, and she was very, very, you know, very, obviously very anxious. So like, for like couple of nights before first grade even started, a child who usually sleeps through the night was getting up every couple of hours. So it finally came to be one night, this is like the third or fourth night already, at around 4 o'clock in the morning, once again she's up, you know, crying and needing me. And I finally turned to her and I said, Rachel, it's 4 in the morning. Ima needs to teach Torah tomorrow. I must go to sleep. And without batting an eye, she says to me, right now, I need you as an ima, and I need you to stay awake. She's right. That's where it's at. That story, I think, demonstrates the challenge that we have. We're exhausted. We want to go to sleep. We have a full day of work the next day. But right now, we're an ima. And an ima means staying up with her. And that's where it's at, called a spade a spade. And that's why Rav Masisyahu notes, he says that a husband and wife have to work together to create the best situation possible. And he notes, he says the ksuva has not changed. The ksuva says the husband is supposed to support the wife. So yes, if there is an agreement, let's say in a kollel environment, he says, where a wife is going to go out to support the husband, he should never feel like, magia li, I deserve this. He should recognize that this is a chesed, a kindness his wife is doing. Help her out. Be as much of a partner as possible. Do the grocery shopping. Do the carpool, whatever it is. It can't all be on her head. The load is just too tremendous. Now, having said this, we know that we face another challenge that I believe is very prevalent within our society. Understanding that a woman's role is first and foremost and really cannot be replaced by anyone, not a babysitter, not even a father, as good as he is, the mother's role. We find in our society today that there's almost a drive, if it's not an economic necessity, that somehow women feel that they need to go out into the workplace. And I think part of this is in some of our institutions of teaching our children, where we focus them so much on the career track that we don't build up motherhood as something that's beautiful, as something that's special. We teach them, and we should, to be creative, intelligent people, that the world is open in front of you. Do whatever you want. And therefore, they come to look at motherhood as like a secondary job, as something that's not of primary importance. And part of this is contemporary society. As Rabbi Fran notes and listens to your messages, he says if you have two people meeting on the plane, within the first couple of minutes, they ask each other, what do you do? What do you do means, what profession are you? And your profession defines who you are. Your profession equals status, and status equals self-esteem. And this is the American mindset. He notes in 41, think about it, how children are conditioned to this mindset from their very early childhood. What do you want to be when you grow up? We ask a little boy or a little girl. And they are expected to answer, I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, a dentist, a business person. But that is not really the appropriate answer. The question is, what do you want to be? The answer ever only addresses what they want to do. Unfortunately, in contemporary society, those are one and the same thing. You are what you do. Who are you? I'm a doctor. I'm a lawyer. That's who I am. That's what defines me. And unless I achieve success in my profession, I'm a failure. This is not Torah value. As the Brisker Rav told somebody, business is not what you are. Business is what God gives you. What are you? There's only one answer. In every Anochi, I'm a devout Jew. The next time you come to a chasna and someone asks you, what do you do? Who are you? You answer, I try to be an Eved Hashem. I try to be an Ein Bisrael. I try to be a servant of God, a mother in Israel. Okay, obviously, to look at you as if you came out of Mars and landed on Pluto, that may well be. But that's where it's at. A doctor doesn't define who you are. Who are you? What do you want to be? We're human beings, not human doings. That's part of the trap. And he says people are embarrassed in 43 to write on a form, I'm a housewife. It's an embarrassing thing. But if you think about it, the responsibilities that a woman has at home for the social and material, psychological and medical responsibility for all of her children, it's an enormous, enormous, enormous job. Now, having said this, we now enter into the next challenge of woman working outside the home. The first being, that's her primary responsibility, and when she comes home, she is so frazzled that she needs the cake and cookies and the warm hug and not the reverse. And this reversal of role leads to a mother who's very difficult to really function appropriately in a calm manner and allow the rest of the night to stay in that way. The second is, or my friend notes in Source 45, he speaks about our story about Dina going out, and he says plainly, Chazal condemned in 45 Dina for eagerness to leave the protection of her father's house to become acquainted with those living around them. But if so, what is the connection to Leah? Leah's going out on that occasion was considered praiseworthy. Yisachar, the tribe of Torah scholars, was her reward for having traded the Judaim for Rachel. We are left then with a paradox. The same act of Leah's which produced Yisachar also led to an immodest act by her daughter Dina and the terrible consequences that resulted from it. Rav Elia Svei once pointed out in a Good Israel convention that we see from this chazal that even the most laudable venture out of the home, no matter how praiseworthy the motive, carries within it built-in pitfalls. What he is saying is that when a woman leaves the safe confines of her home, She must do so with her eyes open to the dangers involved and exercise extreme caution. Now, before we actually enter into what are some of the dangers, let's now focus for just a brief moment in 46 and 47 of what are some of these pitfalls, some of these challenges that a woman faces aside from one being frazzled. Two, he takes the following scenario. Let's talk about a woman who's a bit older, between 25 and 30, securely anchored in her marriage, her family, her community. She has to face a different problem, which is guilt. She has to watch her children cry in the morning as she pulls out of the driveway, listen to their constant questions about when is she coming home, endure their complaints about their babysitters. Over and over each day, she has to ask herself, am I doing the right thing? And he tells a story here of a regional supervisor for AT&T who on a business trip has to call her housekeeper to hear that her baby has just taken his first steps. I had a similar, perhaps, type of story when I was visiting in South Africa. I had a very, very successful businesswoman who came to me to speak about the challenges of motherhood and the professional life. And she was describing to me how she has very late hours. And she gave me as an example, she said that she had a 6-year-old son who was in first grade. And her 6-year-old left a message on her cell phone. And it went along the following lines. Mommy, I know we're coming home late tonight, but I put my first reader on your bed. I'm beginning to learn. I wanted to share it with you. Please take a look at it before you go to sleep. And this mother was saying, the pain that my child is learning how to read and he has to leave a message on my machine to tell me this, I'm not even around for him to share this with me. This is a struggle that many of us have, that we're not there with our children at crucial milestones to build them, to guide them, to direct them. And then we come to another scenario, also very common. A middle-aged working woman whose children are older do not return home until late the afternoon. She doesn't have to feel guilty that she's cheating them out in the same way as with younger children. But her problem is different. She's expected to be superwoman. Even though half her waking hours are spent at work and commuting back and forth, she's still expected to be the complete wife and mother, making sure the larder is always full, the shirts ironed, the cabinets cleaned, the children well-dressed and well-mannered. In short, she is expected upon her return home from work to slip into a phone booth a la Clark Kent and come out wearing an apron proclaiming supermom. And I think all of us are equally familiar with this challenge. How do you do it all? How are you involved in working, in perhaps communal work, in raising the family, in going out to simchas? How many parts are us? I understand that genetic cloning is becoming more popular, but it's not there yet. And we are not cloned, and we are one person. And our children, for a very specific amount of time, really need us. Our homes need us, and we have different responsibilities at different ages. The challenge is that the time our children really need us is the time they go to school. And that's the time when tuition is the highest. And that's the time we have to go out to work. And that's the time that the pressure is on for the woman to accomplish all of these things. Recognize that there are challenges. Don't expect that you have to be superwoman. Recognize that this is something we all go through. And that is why priorities is the crucial aspect in life. And being able to know where I need to focus and what I need to focus in on and how I can be able to divide up the roles and responsibility is equally important. Now, having said all of this, we now enter into, if I understand that the woman is the one who reflects and filters, I understand that the woman's major places in the home, Achakamti, Ein Bisrael, Devorah's highest praise is that she's a mother, not a prophetess, not a poetess, not a judge, but a mother. And I understand that a mother who works outside of the home is going to come back frazzled, is going to have these challenges of how to be able to be fully involved in one's work and yet fully involved in their children's lives. How you're able to both to juggle everything in life, it seems overwhelming and impossible. And on top of that, many people take their one day off Sunday and go to a shir. I mean, this is really, you know, adding what we call the cherry on top of the cake. Having said all of this, we then enter into Vatetze Leah, Dina bas Leah, we can't ignore what happens in the workplace for many people as well. 49. Nor can we ignore the inherent dangers of the workplace. Our standards of modesty and propriety in speech and action are far from those of the society at large. The suggestive comments, the off-color jokes are commonplace. The way people interact with each other very often, there are no appropriate boundaries. People say things, people do things that are just what we would call inappropriate. That's why I remember in the SNEAS video, Robertson Bronstein, Aleh Shalom, mentioned that you have to set up gedarim, you have to set up some type of fences. And one of them may be insisting on being called by your last name at work. It's harder to flirt with a Mrs. than it is with a Judy, let's say, or whatever your name is. 50. Of course, not all contact between the sexes in the office takes the form of sexual harassment. There's also a great deal of camaraderie. Men and women are thrown together in close contact. They work together under pressure on big projects, the outcome of which becomes, at least for the moment, the most important thing in their lives. Everyone is well-dressed, seen at their best, and unfortunately, women are often treated better and with more respect than in their own homes. And this, too, threatens marriages. And we need to be aware of this. We need to be aware of that our environment affects us. And we need to be able to very carefully say to ourselves, what is it about our environment? What work situation am I putting myself in each and every day? And that's why many women have opted if they can. And now with the computer age, it's a little bit easier to work from home. To be able to create the environment that is most appropriate for us. But many people don't have that option, and they're thrown in an environment of people who are inappropriate, or people who are treating them with such great respect that when they come home and don't get that respect, they feel that they're getting more from their work environment than the home environment, and that also uproots the home environment as well. Just like to mention the flip side for just a moment, and that is men who go out to work where women are dressed in their best. And then they come home to women who are in their robes with applesauce and baby food and, you know, like their tickles half on, half off, greeting their husband with the trucks and the cars all over it. And, you know, she's holding a half a diaper in her hand when he walks in. Hi! You know, that also creates a tremendous challenge for the husband. I'll tell you a story, which is, I think, a story of a tremendous lesson. Perhaps I've shared it before, but it's worth repeating again. I had a student in EULA many years ago. When I asked to write an introspective essay, this girl happened to be from an Iranian background, an 11th grade girl, explained what it was that brought her to a Shomer Shabbos environment, why she is keeping a Shomer Shabbos home in an environment which is not the way her parents are and has to fight tremendous amount of difficulties in order to maintain a certain religious standard. And she wrote me the following story, and again, I could have shared it. It's a great story. She said in eighth grade, she was at a Shabbaton at her teacher's house. And they're there Thursday night preparing by cooking and getting things ready. And the phone rings, and it's obvious from the conversation that it's this woman's husband, her teacher's husband, on the other line. And her teacher says, if you don't mind, before you come home, could you just pick up some bottles of grape juice? And at the time, she thought it was a little bit odd because there were cases of grape juice in the kitchen. Like, they weren't short of grape juice. Like, how much grape juice do eighth grade girls drink? Okay. Then after she hung up, this teacher excused herself for a number of moments, and the students continued in the kitchen. 15, 20 minutes later, the doorbell rings, the husband comes home, and she says he's carrying grape juice bottles in hand. The teacher, his wife, comes down dressed like she's going to a chasna. Beautiful clothes, makeup, jewelry, bedecked to the fullest. And then this girl understood that the husband was coming home earlier than usual, and she wanted to stall him that she could present herself appropriately before the husband came home. And she said that made such an impression on her, the way a Jewish home should look between a husband and wife, that was the pivotal decision that she decided to become from. And this is something that's a Musar Haskel for us as well. Having said this, for both the husband and wife, Rabbi Friend, in listening to your messages in 52, says, every one of us who steps into the secular world, who ventures into the professional arena, must be fully aware that he or she is walking across a roaring fools on a tightrope, and he has to make sure that there are safety nets to catch him if he stumbles. What are these safety nets in 53? Our homes, our yeshivas, our rabbanim, our spouses, who can tell their mates when they're veering from the path. The time is we set aside for learning, for doing mitzvos. All of these are safety nets without which going out into the world would be like crossing Niagara Falls on a tightrope, foolhardy and dangerous. Now, obviously, before I mention the second level, there are people out there who are saying, you know, it may be hard. I understand all of these challenges, but for some women, it's hard to stay home all day. It's hard to be with their kids all day. And I understand this as a challenge, and it definitely is a challenge, particularly in our world, where, in my personal opinion, sometimes we do a disservice to girls. And I see this in the seminary world, where we focus so much on the intellectual aspect, which is important, but then that we almost created our own problem that women don't feel satisfied and fulfilled. Yes, women need to feel satisfied and fulfilled. Don't get me wrong. But there has to be appropriate ways. So if a woman can't be home all day, so let her do chesed, let her volunteer, let her create projects, let her do things that are appropriate and very creative with her energies, but be very well aware of what price it has on her family if she doesn't have to go out to work, what time constraints does it put on her, and be very well aware of what environment she is reflecting. Because again, a woman who comes into a secular environment, but Tetzei Dina, this is what we're talking about. The environment you put yourself into has a real repercussion on who and what you are, and in terms of the speech that you bring into your home, in terms of the mindset and the way we walk and the way we talk, we're very much influenced by the environment that we find ourselves in. Now, having said all of this, I'd like to now present a whole different view of this story and a whole different view of Rashi. And in fact, the Malbim on the last page in 56 notes, Vateitse Dina, Modia ki Dina lo ashma b'zeh, Dina's not at all at fault. Shelo tomar, shepirtza geder tzniyus, she didn't break any breach of inappropriate modesty. She was the daughter of Leah, and Leah was snua ba'ola. She was a modest woman. Asher yalda le'Yaakov, and he is a modest person. She is a kosher. She went out, lived rope, lived no ta'aret, and there was nothing wrong in that which she did. Rabbi Uziel Milevsky, and there Uziel develops this, and he says in 54, Rashi saying that it was inappropriate for Leah to go out to greet her husband, he says, makes no sense. She went out to greet her husband. She didn't go out to greet a strange man. And he says we need to understand what this extroverted personality of Leah is all about. And he quotes in 55, another medrash. We learn that Yaakov prepared for his imminent encounter in this week's parasha with Esav by taking his two wives, his two handmaids, and his 11 sons, and sending them across Yabok River. In reference to this verse, the sages ask, and where was Dina? To which they answer, Yaakov had concealed her in a locked trunk so that Esav would not see her and become infatuated with her. The sages say Yaakov acted improperly in hiding Dina, and he was held responsible for this act. He was punished in kind for withholding her from Esav, since she could have positively influenced him, for she would have caused him to repent for her sins. Because he withheld her from Esav, that is why she fell into the hands of Shechem, and it had nothing to do with Dina going out. The sage's criticism of Yaakov seems unfair, though. What option did he have? Should he willingly give his daughter to a scoundrel like Esav? No reasonable person would have done such a thing. Yet, the sages seem to criticize Yaakov for doing this. How do we understand this? So he notes the following. 57. Originally, Leah, Dina's mother, was destined to marry Esav. She had the ability to rectify Esav's adverse character traits. Theirs was a match made in heaven, for Esav and Leah shared critical aspects of their personality. Unlike Yaakov, who sat in tents and studied Torah, Esav was in the habit of going out to the fields to hunt game. Similarly, Leah was not one to wait at home for her husband. When Yaakov came from the field that evening, Leah went out to meet him. She had the ability to influence his behavior and guide him back to the path of the righteous forefathers. But Leah did not want to do this. She could simply not bring herself to marry the likes of Esav, even though in potential she was destined to marry him and could have potentially brought him back. 58. Leah was not completely exonerated from her predestined task. The mission that she had herself rejected was assigned to her daughter Dinah, who inherited from Leah the very characteristics that would have enabled Leah to tame Esav's passion and guide him back to the path of righteousness. Yaakov understood the role Dinah was meant to undertake because of her unique strength, and that is precisely why he concealed her. Like Leah, he was nervous to give Dinah over to Esav. And here's the key. He notes in 59 that habitual tendencies cannot be repressed. Unless one channels them properly, they birth forth unpredictably, usually with disastrous results. When the naturally outgoing nature Dinah had inherited from Leah was not employed for the constructive purpose of bringing Esav back to the fold, as God had originally intended, it backfired, causing Dinah and her family untold anguish. Since Dinah felt an irresistible urge to go out, she made an attempt to establish contact with the Canaanite girls, to introduce monotheism to them. Dinah could not suppress the urge to apply her dynamic personality to positively influence others and shape their behavior. She felt driven to change somebody, if not Esav, then the Canaanite girls. Unfortunately, Dinah did not take into account the dangers which every outreach professional, that which we spoke about, those who go out, have to be aware of. Hence, we see that the sages were not criticizing Leah for being an outgoing, extroverted woman. They merely explained what it was that motivated Dinah to go out to Canaanite girls and attempt to establish a new Torah outreach center for women in the city of Shechem. On this level, we're not criticizing Leah and we're not criticizing Dinah. When the Torah says that she is Dinah bas Leah and Leah went out and Dinah went out, we're talking about a character trait that they both had. And this character trait, if used appropriately and used correctly, has a tremendous, tremendous desired result. It's not that a woman has to stay home all day, that a woman has a role going out, but a woman has to realize, and this is the key, what this role is all about. And that brings us to our final insight for today, based on the writings of Lubavitcher Rebbe, the insight story, Rabbi Tauber 61. The Torah is very clear about the different characteristics and roles imparted by the Creator to man and woman. This was something that Newsweek discovered in the early 1990s. There was a headline, Men and Women Are Different. Yes, that was a chiddush. That was a novel idea they discovered. But we understand that man is a conqueror, charged to confront and transform a resistant, often hostile world. To this end, he has been supplied with an extroverted and aggressive nature, a nature he is to apply constructively in the war of life, the war to combat the negative without, and to redeem the positive elements. Woman is his diametric opposite. Her intrinsic nature is non-confrontational, introverted, modest. For a man battles the demons without, woman cultivates the purity within. She's the mainstay of the home, nurturer and educator of the family, guardian of all that is holy in God's world. The entire glory of the king's daughter is within. Moving up to 60, but within does not necessarily mean indoors. The woman, too, has a role that extends beyond the home, extends also to the most alien of daughters and the most pagan of lands. A woman who has been blessed with the aptitude and talent to influence her sisters can and must be an outgoer, periodically leaving her haven of holiness to reach out to those who have lost grounding and direction of her lives. 62, and when she does, she need not and must not assume the warrior stance of the man. Confrontation and conquest is not the only way. There's also a feminine way, a gentle, modest, compassionate way. Even the fiercest of battle needs the feminine touch of the outgoing woman. So it is a place where women who have special skills, women who have that which they can contribute to society, these women need to go out and to give and to share that which they have that is special, that is unique. But when they go out, even under this interpretation, they go out in a feminine type of way. They go out not in a conquering type of way. They go out in a way which is coming from the feminine, gentle way to deal with the outside world. And in that way, to create an ability to change and to allow the world to grow. So that is why, if a person, for example, wants to do Kirub, so a 63 notes partners in Torah from the privacy of your own home is definitely one way that a woman can go and do this. For some women who have this talented personality and who feels that she's able to do this, so there are other ways that she can go out and do this, but there are ways that are done that don't compromise her feminine personality, and that there are ways that she can go out and affect those whom she teaches. I know personally I often get a lot of critique from people. How come I don't teach men? Why is it that I'm so sexist and I only teach publicly women? And I keep on trying to say that a woman and a man have different ways of approaching Torah, approaching life. And there's nothing wrong with women teaching women and men teaching men. And if men want to teach women, gesunte hate. But we have to recognize the uniqueness in women. And I think, my friend, that is the ultimate message that I'd like to leave us with. And the title of the shiur is A Woman's Role. To understand a woman's role means to be comfortable in being a woman. To be comfortable in being a woman means that you're comfortable in being the moon reflecting, being a mirror, being that which is the ability to distill outward and understand the Ateres Baila, that you can be the crown of the family, that you have a tremendous potential and a tremendous energy that you can really reflect and take in and then distill out. All of this in this world, you're not limited. Shasani Kirtsono, we are created in God's image. But we need to understand that when we appreciate what our roles is and we recognize that our focus is building these precious neshamas, these future worlds, we recognize also that sometimes financial constraints take us outside the home. Let's be aware of what those dangers are to go outside the home. Let's be aware of what it means that when we have to go outside, the effects it has on our children, the effect it has on our family, what it means to be in those environments, the way it affects us. And according to the second view, that there is a positive role of women going out, understand that a woman has a special way to be able to express this uniqueness as a woman. And my bracha to all of us as women is that we're able to appreciate what makes us special and that we're able to be able to balance all our different roles to be able to reflect the holiness of above and create an environment and atmosphere in our home of Kedusha and Tara, of purity and of holiness.